It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Remember records?
So I had just bought a house. I just moved in there. I was just walking around the neighborhood right as we'd kind of finished construction. I set up the turntable, and all of a sudden there was this new record store that had recently opened and I'd never seen it. And of course, it was a 4-minute walk from my front door.
Writer David Sachs.
This place, June Records, it was almost like an Apple store in the way they designed it. All white, very clean, very precise in the way they'd organize the racks. It had that fresh record store smell. They didn't have a window display. They had a turntable in the window and a little speaker outside that was playing what was going on. I'd like to leave you saying, reach out and turn. And it was this Aretha Franklin album, which was Aretha live at the Fillmore West, I think 1971 or 72. Music had almost vanished from my life. And suddenly, here it was, spinning this disc of melted plastic with sound waves pressed into it, and Aretha Franklin's voice coming out of it. What kind of a heartless human being would I be to continue walking down the block and not pop into the store and buy that Aretha record and start adding to a record collection that I really hadn't built up in a couple of years?
So a lot of us are having this kind of experience, falling in love with something like a vinyl record, or maybe a camera with film, or a beautiful notebook that you can write in with pens, not pixels. But what is behind this analog renaissance? Well, Steve Paulson asked David Sachs, author of The Revenge of Analog.
The best analogy I have for it is the world of food, right? We're able to process bread to get flour in a way that it would have this incredibly long shelf life, and we didn't have to worry about spoilage and hunger, you know, going back to pre-World War II. And all of a sudden, you know, by the 70s, a lot of people were saying, all right, I'm tired of this Wonder Bread. I'm tired of this. What else is there? Let's go back to making sourdough the way it was. Whereas now, you can't swing a mocha chai latte without hitting an artisanal toast somewhere. And it's very much a move backward, right? It's very much looking at the way things were done, not out of a sense of nostalgia, but actually looking at the qualitative experience and saying, yes, okay, now that I know I can eat what I want in the most efficient and expensive way, when I choose to eat something, when I have some extra money, when I have extra time to cook things, where am I going to go? I'm going to look at what's going to give me the richest experience.
It's interesting that you use the word nostalgia, because that is one explanation for why there is this return to all this sort of handmade stuff or, you know, physical stuff. Or it's the hipsters. The hipsters are the ones who go and, you know, are buying all the vinyl records.
Or my favorite, the nostalgic hipsters. Now at Urban Outfitters, which is funny. I was emailing with someone from Urban Outfitters and, you know, they acknowledge that nostalgia is a lot of their bread and butter. First of all, I don't think there's anything wrong with nostalgia, right?
Is there anything wrong with nostalgic hipsters?
They cannot exist without it. That is their nature. It is like riding a bike with more than one gear.
But what's interesting is that you do both. I mean, it's not as if you've rejected your digital life here, but you sort of have these two simultaneous worlds, the analog world and the digital world.
And I think that's the part of the argument that those who say it's just nostalgia don't really understand. Nostalgia would involve people sort of going Ted Kaczynski and moving to a cabin in Montana and only using a typewriter. The reality is most of the people embracing analog goods and ideas today are doing it in concert and in parallel with the digital tools that they're using either in work or for their personal lives. So when you go into a coffee shop or a lecture hall at the University of Wisconsin, someone is sitting there at their desk working on a project for whatever business they're in. They're going to have a laptop open. They're going to have a smartphone next to it. And next to that, they're going to have a paper notebook, a Moleskine notebook or a Field Notes notebook or some other random collection of paper with a pen. it's not as though these things are competing with each other. These technologies are complementary. And it's the use of all of them simultaneously and in concert that's what allows those people to work at their best. So certain ideas are going to go down on paper and then be transferred and refined on the laptop screen. Each serves its own purpose, and that purpose is very individual to the user, to each of us. I think it's that mixture that allows us to move with the digital technology in a way that actually doesn't feel as though things are escaping or moving too fast from us. It grounds us in something that's familiar in behaviors and patterns that are in many ways functional and are not inferior to the digital technology. For a lot of people, even people who work at very high-tech companies, it actually allows them to work better with the digital technology.
Right. Now, one of the more surprising trends that you write about is the return of the bricks and mortar bookstore. And it turns out even Amazon, the big chain that basically killed borders, has opened physical bookstores in cities like Seattle, Chicago, Portland, Oregon. How do you explain the return of the bookstore?
There's a couple of different factors here. There's the economic factor of sort of the Great Recession. And the reality was that Amazon may have played a role in the contraction of independent bookstores when there was, you know, 4,000 or more, let's say in the 1980s, up to it's about 1,800, 1,900 today, independent bookstores. You know, most of that was due to Borders and Barnes & Noble. And what were Borders and Barnes & Noble and other sort of big chains able to do that those bookstores weren't? They were able to offer the lowest price and the biggest selection, the most books at the lowest prices, which the mom and pop had a lot of trouble competing with. Well, Amazon came along and said, we can offer every book forever, and we're willing to take a loss on all of them because our real business is raising our stock price and selling data services or drones to someone. And that really hit Borders, who went bankrupt, and Barnes & Noble, who has continually struggled to sort of maintain their place and has contracted somewhat. But it changed the narrative for the independents. The independents could say, we're not going to offer you the most. We're going to actually offer you a curated selection, a very personal selection to this community.
And we're going to offer you an experience. You come into the bookstores, it's not just to buy a book. There's more going on there.
It's community, right? It is a place where ideas live and thrive, and you can have conversations with people and see authors there. When you think about the great bookstores around the country, Books and Books in Miami and Powell's in Portland, Oregon, and City Lights in San Francisco, and on and on and on. These places are hubs of a community. They're places where you can go and take your kids for a couple hours and just sit them in the kids section and let them read stories and flip through books. There are places where you can walk in and say you're starting a book club and ask for recommendations and have a conversation. Have someone open you up to new ideas. That is a premium. That is something that people increasingly value. They know, everybody who shops at these stores, they know you can buy those same books cheaper at other places. But it sells really well in those types of stores because those who value books, they realize that it's a small luxury in their life. It is something that's worth paying for. And they also have seen what happens to their communities when those stores leave, right? When a bookstore isn't in a community, it doesn't get replaced by something of an equal cultural cachet of an equal place. It gets replaced by a pharmacy or, God forbid, a vape store. Where you could go in and have an intellectual conversation about what it tastes like to smoke grape.
You have other examples of this revenge of the analog. And one of them is you talk about the summer camp you went to as a kid, Camp Walden, which I guess has banned a lot of digital devices, right?
Yeah, there's this interesting choice that summer camps now have to make because digital technology is ubiquitous in the lives of their campers. And so they've decided, is this something we want? Do we want all the kids to have cell phones and Instagram every day on the canoe docks, or do we want this to be sort of a screen-free space? And so Walden made this choice. It would be a screen-free space. And they enforce it. So they said, if we catch anyone with a phone, any device that has a connection, we're going to take it away and send it back to your parents. And, you know, you'll be punished. You won't get extra snack on nacho night. But what was interesting is that every summer there's still a dozen or more kids that bring up phones. They get caught by doing stupid things like liking the post of their photo on the camp's Facebook page. They're still kids. And it was interesting. I went back to Walden a couple summers ago. I spent the night there in the same old bunk that I slept in as a 9-year-old. And I remember talking to some of these kids whose phones had been taken from them and asking them why they did it. And it was, in many cases, their parents wanting to stay in touch with them, but also this fear of missing out. And once they had had the phones removed from them, they said it was the best thing ever. It was like this weight had been lifted. The anxiety was gone and they could just be kids. They could have those connections that the other 10 months of the year when they're constantly on Snapchat or Instagram, even when they're with their friends, they don't have. And so they had a deeper relationship. They built deeper relationships.
Yeah. And what's interesting is that I'm guessing that these kids are young enough that they've probably grown up with all of these digital devices. I mean, they've never known life without them.
There's a great story I have from last summer, which is when my friend's daughter, Abby, turned 9, and she was at our house on her birthday. And she got a Fujifilm Instax camera, which is Fujifilm's very popular instant film camera. That was the gift that she had begged her parents for. That's what she wanted, okay? This is a girl who has only known photography as something that happens on an iPhone or an iPad her entire life. Why did she want a film camera? Not nostalgia. She'd never heard of film before. She had no connection to Polaroids in the past. It was not something she knew about other than what was on the cover of a Taylor Swift album. To her, it was its own thing. It was a magical thing that could spit out a photo that she could give to her friend, she could write on, she could tack to her wall. She saw the benefit of that in a way that even her parents and my generation is still ambivalent about. You know, oh, well, that's an old thing. That's nostalgia. You're just being a nostalgic hipster. A 9-year-old is not a nostalgic hipster. They see the value of analog goods, of time away from the screen if it's given to them, if they're given the opportunity for it. And these kids at the summer camp saw the same thing, right? The kids at Walden, 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds, 13-year-olds, they said, of course, we love our phones, we're always on it, but we value this time. We look forward to these 2 months because it's that time away from it, when we have to do other things, when we have to sit by a campfire and play with whoopee cushions and do these things that kids naturally love. They get a joy from, but they're almost prevented from doing it by the constant presence of digital technology.
The record stuck. The record stuck. The record stuck. The record stuck.
David Sacks is the author of The Revenge of Analog, Real Things, and Why They Matter. He talked with Steve Paulson. Remember what it was like to put on a record? The pop and skip, the scratch and hiss. Some people love that sound, like novelist Hari Kunzru.
One of the things that became really fascinating to me about listening to old recordings is actually how hard it is initially to really listen through the crackle and through the bad sound of a worn old 78 record. You know, we're so used to beautiful stereo productions that when you first hear one of these records with a weak voice and a barely audible guitar, perhaps, and a lot of surface noise, you can't get there. But after a while, if you listen to a lot of this and you get better at kind of hearing through the static, all sorts of things emerge. Now, on this record, hearing somebody like Mississippi Joan Hurt sing "In Avalon Is My Hometown, It's Always On My Mind."
Avalon, my hometown, always on my mind. Avalon, my hometown, always on my mind. Pretty mama's in Avalon, want me there all the time.
This guy has a very sweet, very beautiful voice, and there's something about that that just sort of leapt through this noise, leapt through time to me. I became a sort of junkie for this moment of very simple performances, very unmucked around with performances, you know, in whatever style. Now I started listening to field recordings. You know, John and Alan Lomax made a lot of amazing recordings of people. In some of those recordings, you can hear things. I use it in the novel. You can hear the cicadas in the trees. You can hear somebody's foot against the rough boards of the porch that they're sitting on. You can hear somebody in the background tapping time on their knee. That's an amazing thing to me. after you've been listening for a while, it becomes a kind of memory of a time that really has been almost erased. And because these recordings are made by people who were not considered important and historically significant at the time, it's a history from below. It's a history of hard-working people and often very seriously exploited people. And you find lines that actually tell you about what it would be like working on a chain gang, on a levee camp, you know, cutting cane on the Brazos in Texas, and how you would deal with your overseer. Do you going to the white boss and saying that you want your money, and him spitting on the ground and saying, you know, I'm not going to pay you, what are you going to do about it? You hear these things and you can gradually put together a very nuanced picture. Everybody knows about the evils of slavery, and very few people understand properly the kind of much more subtle ways that power was exerted over black people after slavery. And that interested me a lot. I mean, certainly as a British person, I thought I knew the history, and I found, you know, after being in the US and also listening to this music, that there was a lot that I didn't know.
Hari Kunzru's new novel is called White Tears. It's a story about, among other things, old blues recordings. Coming up, it's time to put on our headphones and get a lesson in stereo. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRX.
Boy, I know you're blue. Tell me a black you. I'll do it Auburn Avenue, gal.
Musician Damon Krukowski had a front row seat for the transition from analog to digital culture. Back in the 80s, he was a founding member of the indie band Galaxy 500, and today he's one half of the folk rock duo Damon and Naomi. Lately, he's been thinking about something most musicians and music listeners take for granted, and that's headphones. What happens when most of the listening we do takes place inside our heads? Damon explores the question in a book called The New Analog, Listening and Reconnecting in a Digital World. Doug Gordon sat down to talk with him and find out more.
Damon, your book is called The New Analog, which sounds like a contradiction in terms, since analog is usually considered old school. And when we think of new, we tend to think of digital. Why did you decide to call it The New Analog?
Yeah, I agree. There is a contradiction in the title. Another idea that I was toying with, which could have gone into the title, but it sounds less attractive, I guess, is post-digital, which is a similarly counterintuitive way of thinking of this.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that analog is only old and digital is only new is something that I wanted to confront in the book and challenge. And I think the book, in the end, explodes that. It's not an anti-digital technology book or an anti-new technology book. But I am trying to look at what are the real terms of this switch that we're all living through right now from analog to digital communications. It can't just be old and new, because that's happening always. There's always older and newer things. And digital is, there are all these gadgets. We're all immersed in this world of digital gadgetry right now. But there's something else that's more fundamental, I think, that's going on in the switch of our communications. And that's what I wanted to try and put my finger on in the book.
You say that Pink Floyd's classic 1973 album, The Dark Side of the Moon, is the ultimate headphone album. Why?
Right. Well, it kind of invented that stereotype, and it's a very male-oriented stereotype, I think, of the teenage boy in his bedroom, and I was one of them, with the headphones on, listening to Dark Side of the Moon. And that's kind of a an archetype that was kind of invented in the early 70s and has never really left us as a certain type of way of listening to music. What I point out in the book is that Dark Side of the Moon was very deliberately mixed in stereo for a very particular effect, which was spatial effects that they could bring into the mix by assuming that you were listening on headphones, which means you have one channel in one ear and one channel in the other, like you've put your head between the speakers. And then they can move sounds between the left and the right, and it has the illusion of sounds moving around your head. And this is what was so exciting, of course, as a 13-year-old boy, and is still exciting to people in some ways. What I point out in the book is that that, you know, particular idea of how to manipulate sound and space through people wearing headphones has its place, obviously. But is it really the way we want to be listening to everything? Is it really the way you want to be listening, you know, to your public radio show and to all the music that's being produced today? There are many different types of music, and that sort of spatial effect is actually really not very useful for many of them.
You have this great passage where you talk about how the album opens. Can you kind of walk us through the first side of Dark Side of the Moon?
The first track, which starts with a heartbeat. I mean, I find that so striking because that's not a sound that you hear in the world. It's a sound that you hear in your head. And to me, it's a very strong statement about where this record is going to exist in your world. It's going to exist in your head. And when you put on headphones, I think you have this very inside feeling. You're not listening to sound out in the world like we do when we're just walking down the street or when you hear music coming out of a doorway. You're putting it inside your own head.
Yeah, you're creating your own world. I always think of the Crowded House song Private Universe, because when you put headphones on, that's what you're doing, creating your own private universe.
Yes, and you're not sharing it either. So it's sound that's not shared, just like the sound of your own heartbeat. So that gesture is really carried through, I think, on that record, and it's indicative of what headphones do and what they're powerful for. They're powerful for making a private world like that, for making a kind of an anechoic chamber where you're shut off from the sounds of the world, and you may even be shut off from certain types of sound that music make. For example, the sounds of a room, of instruments in a room. What I found in investigating this question about headphones, which was really just sparked by looking around me and thinking how many people were walking around with headphones in the way I sat in my room when I was 13 years old, and thinking about what people were hearing now more commonly. And one of the things I found is that audio engineers and psychologists who study the psychology of sound, sociology of sound, have studied how people perceive sound in headphones differently than when they're hearing sound out in the world. And the difference is you don't feel that any sound is coming at you from straight ahead when you're wearing headphones. And this is a very strange phenomenon, but if you think about it, or if you're wearing headphones right now, you can test it out for yourself. Sounds can come from the left channel, the right channel. They can come from all kinds of space, sense of space around you in the feeling of space that's been created by this separation. But you'll never hear a sound that seems like it's coming from directly in front
of
you.
This is what you call the blind spot, isn't it?
Yes, there's a blind spot on headphones. And the blind spot is precisely the direction you're facing. So if you're walking down the street wearing headphones, you're hearing sound in your head, and none of it seems to be coming from the direction you're walking. Now, that's a very peculiar situation.
Yeah, it is.
Right? Just in terms of putting everybody, if you're going to say, well, let's have this thought experiment where we're going to have everybody driving and walking and sitting on trains in the world, and no one's going to have a sense of any sounds that are coming directly at them from the direction that they're moving. That's a very strange idea.
It is,
it?
Yeah.
And yet, that's exactly where we are. If you take your headphones off and you listen to sound in the world around you, this is the difference, and this is why sound is very clearly some of it coming from in front of you, which is that each sound in the space that you're in, you're hearing with both your ears, and you're hearing it differently between each of your ears because your ears are on either side of your head, and so any sound reaches them at a slightly different time and different feeling, different timbre, depending on where you are, the space.
Yeah.
Our brains sum that together. They measure the difference between the two ears and use that information to locate the sound in space. So that's what's happening on headphones, and that's why we lose our natural sense of location, locational listening, when we're wearing headphones. What if we could just have music everywhere? I mean, I'm a musician. I listen to music constantly. I love music. Isn't that a utopia? I can carry so many records with me now just on my iPhone, just MP3s. I just carry a set of headphones around and there I am. It's like, okay, that's amazing. But at the same time, isn't it strange that what comes with that is this loss of a sense of where we are in terms of how we hear? We use sound to locate ourselves in space. That's a natural analog sense of our own. But headphones get in the way of it. They quite literally.
Yeah. You say that as our signals are increasingly taken up and used for profit by others, noise may be all we have left to call our own. And you argue that noise has value. What do you mean?
Well, I think that in digital media and in computers have this enormous power to separate what engineers call signal from what they call noise. And what that means in simple terms is you have information that you want to get a hold of. Say you're looking for something on Google. The digital system can put your finger on that so fast. It does that so quickly by eliminating everything that you weren't looking for, which is really the noise. So the people who engineered that software thought, how do I get the signal that this person wants as quickly to them as possible? And that's how that system works so efficiently. Now, along the way, they cut out everything that they decided you did not want to see. And that is noise. Now, here's the thing. Noise can communicate a lot. Say I'm trying to say something intimate to you. I might introduce more noise to my voice. I might whisper. I might try and put something that's not just my words into the sound of my voice. Now, the digital engineer will look at those extra sounds and say, you know, those aren't communicating the message here that's trying to be said, the language, the words. So I'm going to eliminate them. And that's what happens on your cell phone, for example. That's why you can use your cell phone in your car, which is a very noisy environment, with all kinds of white noise around you, because the cell phone engineers have figured out how to isolate the signal of your voice, just the words you want to communicate, without all the noise. Now, that meant all the white noise of the car, but it also meant the tone of your voice, how you're saying that. And so what I'm trying to point out in the book is that that noise may have a lot of information also that we need. And just to let all the digital signals come through loud and clear is a great achievement, but where's all the noise? And where's all the information that that noise communicates? And that's, I think, something we need to look at again before we go another step in Moore's Law.
Damon Krukowski is a musician and the author of The New Analog, Listening and Reconnecting in a Digital World. He talked with Doug Gordon. When you listen to music on your phone or computer or stream it to your stereo, it's often as an MP3. That's an audio coding format that compresses sound files to make them smaller, up to 95% smaller. Shrinking audio files is what lets us fit hundreds of songs on devices the size of a matchbook. The problem is we're not actually getting all of the music. As engineers say, MP3s are lossy. What exactly is being lost? Conceptual artist Kenneth Goldsmith has some thoughts.
The first MP3 that was compressed was the song Tom's Diner. They were able to compress Sinatra, big boom-bastic Sinatra tunes, without noticeable audio loss. But when it came to just a female voice singing this one song, that was the ultimate litmus test for compression. Could a song with just an unadorned voice sound good compressed?
Oh, this rain, it will continue through the morning as I'm listening to the bells of the cathedral.
Now, what MP3 compression does is it kind of makes a Venetian blind out of a song so that your mind fills in the blanks and makes those connections.
I am thinking of your voice.
So this guy named Ryan McGuire, who was a graduate student at the time, actually took all of the material that was taken out of Tom's Diner and represented it as an audio work in and of itself. So the Suzanne Vega MP3 sounds like Suzanne Vega, but here's all the stuff that was taken out of it.
Oh,
And it sounds beautiful and ambient and strange and echoey and ghostly. I believe it was called The Ghost in the MP3. We're all becoming archivists. I've got more MP3s on my hard drive than I will ever be able to listen to in the next 10 lifetimes. And yet, I keep acquiring more. So in a sense, the acquisition of these artifacts has overwhelmed the use of those artifacts. And we've all sort of become librarians, which has led the alt-librarian Rick Prelinger to say that archiving is the new folk art.
I am thinking of your voice.
Suzanne Vega with her 1987 song, Tom's Diner. Kenneth Goldsmith is a conceptual poet and author of Wasting Time on the Internet. We've been talking about the things people miss about the old analog world. Vinyl records, cassette tapes, anything made of cardboard and paper. Well, writer Virginia Heffernan has her own personal catalog of analog items she misses. She just might be the only person in America nostalgic for landline telephones. But Virginia was also an early convert to digital. She started messing around with computers when she was only 9 years old. They were magic to her then, and they still are. In her new book, Magic and Loss, she calls the internet the great masterpiece of civilization.
Yeah. A radio-ready version of the sort of macro history that sentence, the internet is the great masterpiece of civilization, is that civilization moves from more material to more abstract. So you take the history of, say, finance, beginning with just mined gold to gold ingots to, you know, minted gold ingots with inscription on them to paper with inscription on it, very like a book. Then, you know, it's the letters and the symbols on the dollars that make it meaningful. And then to electronic pulses all the way to Bitcoin, one of the most abstract things there is.
So are you suggesting that historically we're in this continual battle to transcend the physical? Because that seems problematic. We are fundamentally bodies.
Yes. And I think that that is a really interesting and ultimately productive tension in the larger story. But I want to give you another view. So there's a lot of alarmism around, say, girls being harassed and particularly sexually harassed using digital technology. So I read a book about this with lots of interviews with young women, and it was really interesting to see how horrible things happen where their faces are grafted onto naked bodies and the porn is distributed to blackmail them. And, you know, it's really obviously terrible, and I can see it being heartbreaking to the girls. I mean, I've been hazed on Twitter many times, and it does wreck your day, but it doesn't damage your body, right? That's potentially a reform on actual physical rape, disease, teen pregnancy.
Well, I think you've put your finger on this tension, you know, the physical versus the abstract. I guess I think maybe you're talking about death versus immortality. You know,
yes.
We're creating a digital world in which nothing can die. And yes, we can't be hurt physically. Isn't the fact that we're beings that can die somehow at the heart of everything good about us? Do we want to live in an immortal world?
No. I mean, I couldn't. I want to leave that with you. I mean, that was beautifully said. I don't think it's an accident that we've seen the rise of these intensely physical practices, almost comically physical practices, you know, almost kind of kindergarten return to let's pay attention to the food we eat, or CrossFit. Just almost brutal, where you're expected to vomit during much of the exercise. That might not be the expectation now that it's become more popular. But I know in the beginning they courted this feeling of misery at the end of their routines.
But I mean, you're saying this is basically in response to our increasingly abstracted digital life. We're craving the physical.
Yes. And, you know, not everything that's great about humans exists in the body. There are also enormous mental and emotional pleasures to be enjoyed in symbols and language and images. You know, I'll give you another example where in Japan, so here we have endless hand-wringing conferences on what to do with our children and the internet and books about it. In Japan, it's the reverse. Kaneshau is a sociologist there, and he's written many books about how it's been a godsend in Japan to have digital culture because people are so straitened by name, rank, and serial number in physical life, in the walking down the street life, in the subway life, and then, of course, in the lives of salary men and women, that they got the internet and all of a sudden they can be shape-shifting. They can have different names. They can write differently. They can enter different worlds, test out different ideologies and different romantic experiences. And what's wrong with the side of us that wants to take beautiful pictures and put them on Instagram? That's not a corrupt, twisted, horrible, overly civilized part of our nature. That's baseline artistic expression.
One of the things I really liked about reading your book is the sense of wonder you brought to the internet and to digital culture. And it kind of restored it for me because I guess you spent a lot of time reading people talking about the internet as toxic or poisonous in some way or another and talking a lot about what we've lost. There are a few moments in your book when you were talking about how many people are online at any one time, or how many people, what did you say, that the number of cell phones and the number of people on the planet is approximately the same by
They're
now?
They're almost at par. Cell phone subscriptions. Yeah, that's right. You know, the first screen I ever looked at, that screen had the black background and the green phosphorus letters in the front. I spent so long just trying, almost semi-consciously, unconsciously, trying to fathom what was back there, you know? It's very interesting that that interface looked so much like the night sky. You know, something bright and legible and symbolic to make sense of, you know, with constellations and use that left part of your brain in the front. And then this infinite regress yonder back there in the darkness.
I've forgotten that. There was something beautiful about that, as though the letters and the meaning was kind of, appearing in front of you out of this darkness.
Yeah. You know, like the beginning of Star Wars, like the letters are somehow on space. And it's sort of, you know, the greatest sublimity of nature, that dark night sky, and the sublimity of mankind, which to me is humankind, which is the invention of language, in this amazing juxtaposition. And finally, when I understood the internet, that early conference XYZ that I joined had at most 100 members. So it wasn't a huge number of people, but it was still a lot of consciousnesses to have appear in some way in your, you know, corner of your parents' bedroom where you were curled up, at, you know, with this computer. When it became, you know, 100 million and then a billion and then 2 billion, and now more than that, my little brain is not enough. It doesn't compute that. It doesn't make sense of that there are somewhere 2 billion minds are potentially available to me on my phone, you know, are with me. And the fact of humanity, I think Marilyn Robinson says this too, just sort of there's a religion itself, I mean, that used to just be called humanism, that is founded in this awe with the human mind and just the enormity of our collective experience.
But do you ever feel like, I can't sit in front of a screen anymore. I can't be in that digital space. I need a break. I need to just be with physical things for a while.
Yes. I just heard a wonderful, wonderful lecture by Marina Warner on the importance of hairiness, that our devices are so hairless. And she calls it glabrous, which I guess is a word from art history, smooth and, you know, like marble. And that, you know, aspiring to the glabrousness of a screen is, as you say, a way to dampen what's best about us, which is that we're living and dying at the same time. And so is much of the material world. You know, Johnny Ive, the designer at Apple, my friend Paul Ford says, like, he loathes us. He just thinks humans are disgusting, you know. the iPhone is meant to be oleophobic, meaning it refuses oil, you know. And in addition to blood and hair and, you know, our oils are one of the best things about us, the oil in our skin. And, you know, it's just constantly the digital culture tells us there's something physically
disgusting
physically
about us.
Disgusting about us. And it's just enough.
As you're listening to the following music selections, adjust the volume, bass, and treble controls to suit your tastes.
Virginia Heffernan is the author of Magic and Loss, The Internet as Art. And that's it for our conversation about the revenge of analog culture. Coming up, the Palestinian-American physician and poet, Fadi Judah, joins us. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRX. Some time ago, we started a poetry project where we asked some of our favorite poets to experiment with writing new work based on the news. News defined very broadly as current events in our world or even in their own personal lives. Well, Fadi Judah is a poet and practicing physician in Houston. He spent years working as an ER doctor and also with Doctors Without Borders. He's the son of Palestinian refugees and an award-winning translator of Palestinian poetry, and this is what he wrote for us.
Brush with symbols. America, I'm downloading your heart, your giga, and my CPU is slow. I will have your Corazon when I'm in the dirt. If Citizen is gold and Revolution silicon, will you take off your clothes and FaceTime me? We're not supposed to. Suppose we are. To end here, we do. And every we is schizo, and I, for every poem a length, and for each span a loyalty oath. America, my motherboard has been acting up since spanking new. My mothership all roots, and we're one boot after reboot. Your windows are apples from a tree. Did I take out the trash? Do I have a curb where I live? A recycling bin? My Monday morning coffee in a black hole? My cigarettes for the homeless on red lights? My lighter handy? Their illness? My transplant? America, if I'm a cloud, let's back up and drive the country to the registry, the libraries, river and sea. To which whale will I lose my files? The gray, the blue, extinction, a synecdoche? America, you're smaller than English, greater than predestination, and I, in wanting wisdom, looked ahead at looking back at Eurydice. Won't you use apoptosis in a poem? I praise thee.
Wow. I love it that your poem made me look up a word. Apoptosis? Turns out it's a medical scientific term.
Sure, yeah.
Meaning?
Programmed cell death and the process around that. I bring it up because it's fascinating that we live in a time where that's our conversation around mortality, is at the cellular level. Advances in gene therapy and stem cell research and so forth. And at the same time, you know, even as a physician, I think we live in a culture where the conversation about dying and illness is terribly lacking. And I think it reflects in our general culture.
What about That first line, America, I'm downloading your heart, your giga, and my CPU is slow. I love that. What were you thinking about when you wrote this? What was going on in your life that prompted it?
Two things. I bought a new computer, a desktop, and it started giving me problems. I'm not the most tech-savvy person, and I got really pissed off. And that's one thing. The other thing was I was reading some essays and writings by James Baldwin in anticipation of going to see the movie I Am Not Your Negro.
Mm-hmm.
So that really is part of what drove this. And obviously, as an Arab American, the rest of it is something I've lived with since my younger days, and I suspect, sadly, I will continue to live with for years to come.
I was wondering about your background. You're the son of Palestinian refugees. I think your family fled following the creation of the State of Israel.
Correct. My father was about 14 or so when that happened. My mother was born in that year. And yes, and that formed their, obviously, the rest of their lives. My father, who was a history professor, and you know, my mother, we went to Benghazi, Libya, where he taught for a little bit. And then he got another job in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, where he taught also there at the university. And by the time I finished high school and knew or that I wanted to pursue medicine, it was, you know, more logical for me to return to the U.S. as an American born and pursue that career here.
That makes me wonder whether you see or what similarities you see between practicing medicine as a physician and poetry.
Yes, that's a good and tough question. The greatest parallel between poetry and medicine is actually about how does one manage uncertainty? Because whenever one of us is ill with something that may be the auger of chronic illness or is a chronic illness, it's a conversation with uncertainty and with what life means and with what the unknown is about. And that's, I think, the most difficult thing to do in medicine, because science does not claim a conversation with the unknown. You know, I did some time with Doctors Without Borders a few years back, and I realized that illness is one of the first displacements that we learn. When you suddenly are not yourself, when you're a young kid and you have a fever and your mother is sitting at the edge of your bed caring for you, and you just feel that what happened, that it just sort of alienated me from my understanding of time, of perception, of my relationship with my body.
Sure, you enter then, into this other world.
Right. And then as we grow older, that other world becomes more present than those episodes in childhood. But somehow I think we don't do enough job to reconcile that feeling of displacement, being one's own refugee, if you will, with a greater empathy and understanding of the larger world.
If I'm reading you right, what you're saying is we all are exiles. For you, it's not metaphoric. It's a family lineage. Can you extrapolate from that then to, for instance, the way Palestinians are seen today in the West?
You know, that's a very difficult question to answer in a sort of a pretty sentence or two. I think the biggest difficulty Palestinians face in the West has to do with the hierarchy of suffering or a classification of suffering.
What do you mean?
What do I mean about the classification of suffering is, for example, the trouble, the ethical trouble of triage, so to bring it back to medicine. If someone comes in with a heart attack and someone comes in with severe pain from a broken wrist, I'd have to figure out that, well, the person with a heart attack is probably going to die pretty quickly. The person with severe pain is not, so I'm going to have to think about the wrist a little later or just give a shot of morphine to alleviate the pain while I attend to the person with a heart attack. In larger collective human suffering, we've convinced ourselves that we're able to do triage, which is to say, an entire people who have been displaced, lost so much of their sense of self and being and belonging, matters less because of a different kind of suffering. For the Palestinian in the West, it's always having to answer to the hierarchy of anti-Semitism as a greater suffering. And I think that's an ethical problem. On a personal level, I would say that when I was with Doctors Without Borders and I was in the refugee camps in Zambia and in Sudan and Darfur, one of the powerful feelings that would never leave me was that there are these moments where I cannot come up to someone there and say, hey, Mr. Daniel, who's an Angolan refugee in Zambia, I don't think your suffering is as bad as those in Darfur, because they're being ethnically cleansed or whatever political names we attribute to collective suffering. Because when you see it there, you realize that the human mind is actually incapable of distinguishing these things. But it's politics that prevent us from, and when I say politics, I mean means to power.
Mm-hmm. So what you're describing is a situation in which you, as a doctor and as a poet, you're working inside power structures. Where does that leave you? How do you negotiate that or manage the difficulty of working inside a system and at the same time not wanting to be complicit?
If I knew the answer, I'd either be a fool or a liar. It's something I struggle with every day, I think, maybe more than I should. And not to be really cheesy in saying this, but the hope remains in having these conversations with people like you. It's a degree of uncertainty because I didn't know that, you know, you exist, but I always believed that you do, in a sense. So just one goes on about their day and attending to small and large things and believe in the good collective of the human race.
Fatty, it's been such a pleasure talking with you today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Fatty Judah is a poet, physician, and translator, and his most recent collection of poems is called A Light. He's also published award-winning translations of Palestinian poets Mahmoud Darwish and Ghassan Zaktan. And if you want to read his poem, it's on our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Gordon produced this hour, and he had help from Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tankekar, and Mark Rickers, and audio engineer Steve Gotcher. Joe Hartke is our technical director, Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.